Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. It's Saturday night, and you're squeezed onto a basement couch watching Saturday Night Live.
Now, as your father probably told you, my name is Matt Foley, and I am a motivational speaker. Now, let's get started by letting me give you a little bit of a scenario of what my life is all about. First off, I am 35 years old, I am divorced, and I live in a van down by the river.
Why are you and everyone around you on the couch laughing? Somehow humor and drama suck us in, even though we know we're watching actors play parts. Think of your reaction to Matthew Crawley finally proposing to Lady Mary, or J.R. gasping when he was shot, or Ross and Rachel kissing in a dark coffee house. Jim Davies looks at the science of what stories and characters, whether they're funny or sad or shocking, do to our brains. He's the author of Riveted, the science of why jokes make us laugh, movies make us cry, and religion makes us feel one with the universe. And he's a professor at Carleton's Institute of Cognitive Science. Jim, thanks for joining me.
You're very welcome.
So, you know, you have done a lot of research on what makes something good. And I want to start with a question that actually occurs to me all the time. Mm-hmm. When people laugh, you know, when they're in a big audience and they think something's hilarious, why? Why do they think it's funny?
So let's not talk about funny for a minute and just talk about laughter, because laughter is kind of more interesting in a way.
And okay.
People laugh when there are funny things, but they also very frequently laugh when nothing is funny at all. So, for example, you'll hear people laughing a lot on roller coasters.
Okay.
And I had a friend who he and his buddy were mugged. And then as soon as the mugger left, they looked at each other and burst out laughing. Often people laugh when they run into a friend that they haven't seen in a long time. So when you start looking at these things, you can start to unpack the reasons that people laugh. And it seems to be the best theory that I've seen is that people laugh because they're trying to communicate something and what to everybody else. And what they're trying to communicate is that everything's okay, even though it feels a little tense and things, you know, it's like they superficially look like they're not good, but things are actually good.
Interesting.
So in the roller coaster case, you know, it's a deliberately designed, terrifying experience. Part of your mind is scared because, you know, things are happening to you that you've evolved to find very frightening. But another part of your mind knows that it's safe and trusts the system that you're in.
Right.
If you actually feel that the roller coaster is not safe, you stop. You won't be laughing. You'll actually just be scared. Right. So it's called benign violation. And so when we turn to things like jokes, the theory is that the reason that we laugh is that the joke always sets you up to expect one thing and it delivers something different. And so what they've done in the lab, actually, they've got these crazy experiments where they have people lift things and they are all of a constant weight. And then the fifth thing is significantly lighter or heavier. And when they lift it, they laugh.
I can totally see that.
That's what's so cool about, you know, these psychology experiments. You just isolate exactly what you're looking for and they find that, you know, just violation of expectation is enough to elicit laughter.
Okay, so when you say this comedian is amazing, you should go see him, he or she is so funny, what you're really saying is they set you up to expect one thing really, really well, and actually they deliver something else?
I think that is all there is to it. I mean, not that it's easy, but the good comedians are brilliant masters of manipulating your expectations and violating them in various ways. Yes.
Have you thought about this in relationship? You must, like, watch television or go to live events or watch movies or whatever and start thinking about, okay, why is this particular person, you know, why is David Letterman so compelling or whoever? Give me a couple of people who, you know, that's occurred to you about and then, like, your explanation of why they're so good.
So one of my favorite comedians is Maria Bamford. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she's really great. And she uses a lot of cultural references that are kind of on the edge of your understanding. You kind of recognize them, but nobody's ever pointed them out before. And by bringing them up in a public forum, you know, it's just hilarious.
I'm trying to bring the kind of anxiety and tension of reality shows into my everyday life. I gathered all my ex-boyfriends into a room for a rose ceremony. Anybody? Anybody?
But I think it's fascinating how, particularly stand-up comics, they specialize in, you know, different kinds of humor. And you have one-liner comedians and storytelling comedians. And, you know, it shows the huge range of what can be funny.
So we've talked a lot about jokes and about laughter. Why, when something's, let's say, not real, like we're watching a movie, why do we cry or find things sad if we know it's not real? It's not like somebody in our family is actually sick. It's the person who's playing a part and they're not actually sick.
Yeah, right. That's been known as the paradox of fiction for a very long time. And I think the solution is, very briefly, the solution is that most of your brain doesn't realize it's not real. When you think about the long history of humanity, even up to the Middle Ages, people had very, very few experiences with what we now would call representations. Everything you saw was pretty much real, right? Even reflections were relatively rare, and echoes were relatively rare. But now we're just bombarded with pictures and magazines and movies and everything. And basically, our minds have not changed much since that time. So the apparatus that your mind uses to detect faces and to understand words works exactly the same when you're listening to the radio, for example, as when you are talking to a flesh and blood person. Your mind doesn't most of your mind doesn't distinguish the fact that those people aren't in the room. So, you know, you can't listen to the radio and just hear noise. You can't help but hear the words. That's an unconscious process that's going on. And likewise, when you're watching a movie, although you can attenuate your emotional response by saying it's just a movie, basically you can't just see light on the screen when you watch a film. You have no choice but to perceive people with goals and desires. And part of your mind thinks it's really happening. Mm-hmm. And this goes along well, for example, with horror movies.
Hello?
Hello.
Who is this?
You tell me your name, I'll tell you mine.
I don't think so.
What's that noise?
Popcorn.
You're making popcorn?
Well, I'm getting ready to watch a video.
Really? What?
Well, just some scary movie.
You like scary movies?
Uh-huh.
You never told me your name.
Why do you want to know my name?
I want to know who I'm looking at.
People have nightmares about horror movies. And one of the good theories of dreams out there is that it's rehearsal for threatening situations. And so, you know, you watch a zombie movie and it terrifies you, and then you start having nightmares about it. What I think of is your mind thinking, I've seen zombies. I need to prepare for what's going to happen when zombies start attacking me. What am I going to do? It's kind of a maladaptive, fear-generating thing. But basically, our minds evolution hasn't had time to catch up and help us distinguish fantasy from reality.
Well, it also makes sense, you know, when you hear from people who have been on television or on radio for a long time, and they've had people come up to them over the course of their career and say, I feel really close to you, and like, I know you've talked about your family and stuff. And it's sort of that, you know, maybe not quite realizing that it wasn't a conversation that went both ways, right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's false sense of intimacy. Sure, there's a study that shows that people actually think of their TV characters as their friends.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you're talking about like a radio personality, for example, might be. I mean, they might be being themselves on the radio.
Right. Talking about their real children or whatever.
But yeah, we're talking about like people playing parts. Like, everyone knows that, like, are playing roles, but they somehow subconsciously substitute them for social relationships.
How much looking has there been at our brains when they're feeling these emotions? So when we're laughing at a joke, when we're feeling sad, even though it is fake sadness, right? You know, feeling sad because we're watching a sad movie. How much have we looked at that?
Yeah, there's no evidence that there's anything like fake sadness, although some people have tried to argue that the emotions you feel when you're watching, you know, engaging in fiction of any kind, you know, a movie or a book or something, isn't real. There really seems to be only one anger pathway in the brain, only one sadness. And it happens in the older part of the brain called the limbic system. And those parts are activated whether you are experiencing a real event or a fictionalized event.
I wonder what the uniting principles are behind compelling things, because we've talked about jokes and other emotions that you experience, you know, either in real life or on screen. What have you found about the science of making something compelling?
In the book, I bring out a bunch of what I call foundations of compellingness, and I'll just talk about a couple of them. And one of them is that we are really interested in social interaction. So human beings have been very, very social creatures, at least since the dawn of agriculture and probably much longer. And so we're kind of hardwired to pay attention to what people are feeling and doing and how they're interacting. So we kind of eat up gossip and other kinds of things because, as I said, when I was saying that our mind doesn't distinguish fiction from reality, when we hear about somebody breaking up or somebody gaining power or something, our minds are naturally going to find that stuff kind of important. And indeed, when they describe – sometimes when they teach scientific theories to students, they'll use, you know, anthropomorphic terms like the water wants to find its own level or something. And it's kind of a crutch, but it makes it easier to understand in the short term. When you look at plots of TV shows and things, you know, characters and their dramas are, you know, that's the name of the game. But what's really neat is when you look at religions, all of the successful religions have what we would call personified gods or deities and spirits, right? So the kinds of religions that have these very vague force kinds of things and power, they don't do so well. Hmm. And it seems that people naturally want to think of the world in terms of other people.
Right.
So, you know, the book talks about others, but that's one of the primary ones, is that we're hardwired for socializing.
That's really interesting. It makes me think of people's attachment to soap operas. I mean, they're sort of exaggerated because obviously there are so many divorces and so many remarriages. But really, the show is trying to amp up the degree to which it sucks you in.
Exactly. Yes. And social change is very, very, very compelling because think about, you know, evolving in a group of 150 people, which is where we spent most of our evolutionary history as humans. Who was sleeping with whom and who was fighting with whom and who was in charge and who was up and coming and who was down and out was absolutely necessary to survive.
Right.
And, you know, it's hard to shake that. So now when we see celebrities and our brains don't even know that they're not part of our community, a lot of our brains, you know, they think that they're right in front of us. We want to know why these celebrities are breaking up with somebody and who they're dating now. And it feels important,
right,
even though these people have nothing to do with our lives, you know.
Right.
And to the same extent, we get drawn into dramas. You know, we watch long TV shows and it just feels very, very important to know what's happening on these screens of ours.
Okay, so now that you've done all this research, when you go to the movies, when you go to comedy clubs, have you totally changed the way you process what's happening around you?
When I'm really captivated, like when I saw Guardians of the Galaxy, for example, I was mostly just in the moment enjoying it. And only once,
right,
in a while would I sit back and marvel at how well it was done. But then, you know, what's interesting is that as I wrote Riveted and was coming up with theories of why certain art is, you know, works and everything, what's really interesting is when I encounter something that works and I can't figure out why. I'm reading a book right now called The Magicians, and the protagonist seems to be without any drive at all, like has no goals, which is breaking all the rules in some sense, but I'm still finding it very interesting. So it's actually the ones I can figure out aren't quite as interesting as the ones that I can't.
Jim Davies is a cognitive scientist. He's at Carleton University in Ottawa, and he's the author of Riveted. Jim, thanks so much for coming in today.
You're very welcome.